Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. It's my pleasure to introduce the speaker tonight, both to our audience here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco and to our radio and online audiences. Tonight's speaker is Stephanie Pearson, a grad student in archaeology and art history at UC Berkeley, and an archaeologist who's worked on the site at Pompeii. And she's going to be speaking about a day in the life of an archaeologist in Pompeii. And as she said, it's not exactly like Indiana Jones, but as you can all see, she looks much more like Karen Black than Harrison Ford.
Thank you, George, and thanks very much to both George Hammond and Patty Lundberg, who are so not only instrumental, but were the ones to invite me here tonight and to make everything work well. And thanks very much to all the Commonwealth members and everybody for coming today. I'm excited to see so many people who want to hear about Pompeii and hear about archaeology, so thanks very much. Now, let's see, I'll speak into the hand mic so that I can walk over here to the screen and gesture around at my slides. So if at any point I get too quiet, then I'll trust the people in the back to help me out and raise a hand. My goals for this evening's talk are several-fold. My primary goal is to introduce you to some of the procedures of classical archaeology, as it's practiced at Pompeii, but really it has a much broader application than just at this site. It's practiced all across the Mediterranean. And I want to do this because, not just because it's very cool, which it certainly is, but because this is a practice that produces some spectacular objects that all of us see in museums, for instance, at the Legion of Honor in our very own San Francisco, and across the world for anybody who's lucky enough to go to Italy, for instance, to see some of the museums here, or even for somebody who just picks up a postcard. There are so many postcards out there with objects that have been discovered through archaeology that I'm just hoping that knowing something about the process that has literally unearthed those things from the ground will give you a little satisfaction. You'll know a little bit more about them. Not only will you know more about how they were discovered and really how the dirt was brushed off them, which we'll go into in detail in a few minutes, but also you'll know how we gain knowledge about these objects. Because, of course, when you see these things in museums, you're not simply looking at a statue on a podium, which there certainly is, or a tiny shard or sherd from a terracotta pot, but you're also able to read a tag next to it that tells you something about it. So I'd like to show you a little bit about the processes that go into creating that knowledge or revealing that knowledge to a certain degree. I'd also like to give you some knowledge tonight that I think is difficult to get in a succinct format in other venues. Because as it is, in fact, there's no classical archaeology textbook that's widely used. And I think that's astonishing as an archaeologist. Maybe you're not astonished by that. But after tonight's lecture, I hope you will be astonished because it is surprising. There are textbooks for so many fields out there. That there shouldn't be one for classical archaeology is surprising. Now, there has been a recent one written within the past 5 years, but it is not being currently used in classical archaeology classes. It's not even commonly assigned even sections of it for seminars in archaeology for grad students and for others, for undergraduates as well. So the fact that this is such a difficult field to get a hold of and to condense to in order to share how it's done, to share the knowledge about it, I think is remarkable. So I'm hoping that we can penetrate that facade of ignorance or uncertainty a little bit tonight. And last but not least, I want to in part dispel some of the myths that might have arisen through popular culture. As I mentioned in the abstract, and as George just recalled, Indiana Jones, for however much we like him, does not show us how to practice archaeology. I don't have a bullwhip. I do have a hat to shield me from the sun, but it's not a fedora. So I'd like to show you some of the practices that really do go on in these sites rather than the ones that are more popularly disseminated. So without further ado, let me jump into my example here, which is, of course, the case study of Pompeii. Now, just to remind you, with a topographical map, which I quite like, so you can see the relief here, we're looking at this part of southern Italy and Sicily, and Pompeii is right in this bay here. You can see this rather large pimple here, which is the volcano Vesuvius, and the Sorrentine Peninsula down below that runs into the Apennines, which forms the spine, so-called, of the Italian peninsula. So we're going right here tonight. Here's another topographical map, just a little bit closer. here's our mountain of Vesuvius. And Pompeii, you'll see marked right here if you're quite close. If you can't see so closely, I'll just point to it for you down there next to Vesuvius, that fateful volcano. Let's go ahead. This is one of the views of the volcano behind with the ruins of Pompeii in the front. This is the insula, which means simply the city block. It's the Latin word for a city block, insula. So this is the insula where my team at Pompeii has worked. This is a team directed by Professor Michael Anderson of San Francisco State University, who's giving a paper at the symposium that George mentioned on Pompeii on Saturday. So Michael has assembled his team to work in this city block here, which, as you see, has a lot of open space, but also some standing walls still on the perimeter. Okay, getting started. So I've divided the talk today into a few sections. The getting started section is, of course, about how do you even start the process of archaeology? How do you choose where you're going to dig a big hole in the ground? Then we're going to move into the processes of digging the hole. What do you do with the things that come out of the hole? And what do you do to finish up filling the hole back in and that sort of thing? So getting started. Here's our wonderful team. This is our director, Michael. And it's a small team, as you can see. This is the bulk of it, plus myself, and then a few others who rotate in and out through the seasons. A map of Pompeii to get us oriented. Pompeii is shaped more or less like a rugby ball, or a football if you speak to American audiences, but it's rather rugby ball shaped. What I'd like to show you is the area in which our team works, outside the city walls here, up at the so-called Herculaneum Gate. I'll show you detail of that area. So here's the street that leads out of Pompeii, leads to Herculaneum. We work in the so-called Villa of the Mosaic Columns, which has produced some beautiful columns covered with mosaic that give it its name, modern name, not what the ancient Romans called it. That's what we call it today as a nickname. So that's this area here. So we've focused on that area, but also the line of shops here. We'll talk a little bit more about this later. We also work in this insula, again, the city block in the interior of the city. That's right by the Forum. The Forum, of course, being the heart of the ancient Roman city, where the public buildings were and a lot of the public market life took place and political life. So we're working in this insula that's right here. It almost abuts the Forum. It's certainly kitty corner to it. Here's a close-up of our insula that shows you the properties as we've marked them out. So these are private houses as well as shops. And again, I'll talk about this a little bit more in a minute. So just take a look for the moment. Now, we have our geographical site. You can imagine being the director of a project at Pompeii, an archaeological project, who has the site of Pompeii on his mind, the city of Pompeii. He wants to use the city of Pompeii to find out something. What does he want to find out? Well, there are research themes that you want to establish from the get-go, but these, of course, develop over time. This is the last theme of the talk today, is how the way that we practice archaeology is recursive. It constantly brings you back to the questions that you thought you started with. It makes you modify the questions, and as you find out more and more, you come back to those questions and revise them, and then revise the way you try to find out about them. So try to think of this as a cycle. It's a cyclical process by which we practice the archaeology, revisit the interpretation of it, back and forth, back and forth. So it's not that you can simply dig the answer up out of the ground. I guess that's maybe a succinct and not entirely incorrect way to put it. So the research themes come out of the place you choose. We've chosen Pompeii, so we're looking into Roman life. And specifically, as you might guess from those two insulae that I showed you, those two places that we work, we're looking at the changing uses of space. And what do I mean by that? We're looking at urban versus suburban space. So you can see in this area by the Forum, we're very urban. We're right in the heart of the city. It's the bustle. This is the most bustling quarter of the entire city right at the Forum. So we're investigating what is that bustle like. But we're also looking outside the city walls. This black line, this heavy black line demarcates the city walls. We're also looking outside to determine, is it different outside the city walls? We think it should be because there's a big city wall there. Isn't what goes on outside it different from what goes on inside it? Seems like it should be, but is that the case? We're finding out actually more and more that it's less the case than you might think. So what I want to point out is that these research questions come from the very places that we decided to excavate. And how do you decide where to excavate? We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But one of the motivations is, where do they allow you to excavate? Where does the superintendency say, yes, you can go ahead and dig a big hole right here? Because digging a big hole is, of course, destructive. It's irreparable once you've dug all the things out of the ground. Nobody can come back and do the same thing again. So the superintendency of the site wants to make very sure that you do it right, that you do it in an appropriate place, and so forth. So it's partly luck of the draw or partly the vicissitudes of the superintendency that determines where we can even dig. So these are the plots that our director applied for and was approved for. He had some other plots in mind, but these are the ones that ended up working out. So that's part of the reason that we did get to look at these questions of urban versus suburban space. We're also looking at public versus private space. We're looking at insulas here and here that include residential spaces, in fact, quite grand residential spaces, but also shops, also public baths, also bars where people could come not just for an alcoholic drink, but this is a term usually used in Pompeii to mean even a place where you can get a quick bite to eat. The tour guides around Pompeii usually call them the ancient McDonald's for however much that gives you as a picture. Finally, we're looking at residential and commercial and municipal space. So this draws on the public versus private, but it's to make a little more explicit that we're looking at large houses like these plots labeled 15, 22, 4, 10. You can see how large these are. They're for really very comfortable houses. But all these smaller plots around the exterior are shops. So we're looking at these commercial spaces of shops. You see how intimately intertwined they are with the residential spaces. In some cases, we think the shops were owned by the same people who owned the houses, so they really are interconnected. And finally, municipal, like this plot number 9 over here, is a big water cistern that's several stories deep, and you can see is about the size of several, I'd say 4 shops put together. Very, very large. This water cistern was a municipal project. It was directed by the government rather than by any individual, as the shops or residences would be. So these are some of the themes that we've determined to look at in both this insula and outside the city, and then to put these in dialogue with each other, the inside and outside the city, the suburban and the urban. Lastly, we're looking at how these spaces, these uses of space, change over time. So I've put up here some designations for the time periods we're looking at. Samnite, referring to a people, an Italic people who lived in Pompeii before the Romans came along. So this is, Samnite designates the culture, the people, the art. It's an adjective applied to any of these, as well as the time period in this case, because they predate the Romans. Republican indicates the earlier Roman period, and finally Imperial indicates the Roman period after the Emperor Augustus comes to power. So we're looking at how things change with these different cultures, different peoples, and in this case, different regimes that come into the picture. Okay, so we've written to the superintendency, we've asked for permission to dig our big holes, and they've said yes. So what do we do next? Go to the library. This is the library on the site at Pompeii. Here's our team researching. What are we researching? We're trying to find out what other work has been done on these places. Of course, you have to do some of this research before you apply to the superintendency. So you can say either nobody's dug here before, we think there's a lot of information to gain, or somebody dug here before, but they didn't find out this thing that we think we can find out. So this is just ongoing library research. Now that we've secured the site, the particular sites of our excavation, we want to make double sure that we know everything there is to know. Everything that's already written down, we want to know it. So we go into the library. Sometimes we find some spectacular things like this. This is a beautiful 19th century watercolor that somebody did of our insula, in fact. You wouldn't recognize it from this picture. This is the forum I was mentioning that's the heart of the political action and market action of Pompeii. This is one of the major temples. And here's our insula, back before it was excavated at all. And in fact, it has a little huntsman or agriculturalist's hut sitting on top. So we were really delighted to find this. So this is useful because it tells us that at this date in the 19th century, that this insula was not dug at all. So we know that there wasn't disturbance at this period, which is useful for us. It limits the amount of disturbance that we know happened during a period of looting, for instance, in the 18th century when lots of people were coming to Pompeii to try to dig up the valuable artifacts. So this is useful for us because it tells us at least we can get a very vague, even a half century sense is useful, sense of what disturbances happened in this place we want to excavate. And here's the picture today of the temple that's been fully excavated, and our insula is just beyond this arch. Finally, this is my back-of-the-napkin sketch here of the previous excavations that happened in our insula. So you'll recognize the outline from the picture I showed you earlier with the same numbers on the same houses and these shops around the exterior. And I've color-coded on this map the previous excavations. So although there were no disturbances in that watercolor in the 18th century, we do know from other sources, mostly written sources, diary accounts, that this house, number 10 here, was excavated, in fact, in 1762. So it's a good thing we started reading through some of those old diaries. And it was excavated in 1808. And in 1868, and in 1873, and in 1910. And finally, the entire insula was cleared again in the later 20th century. So that's to say, these are repeated diggings when some people, especially this 1762 date, people would have come into the insula, taken the bronze things, the nice marble statues, taken them and left, but not done anything else. So then somebody else would come along, say, in 1808, try to find other things. So these are just the recorded so-called disturbances or lootings, really, at this period. And then later on in 1910, that was a real excavation in which things were recorded. Not very well at that stage, but at least they were recorded. So we're very happy to know that number 10, plot number 10 here, we won't find any marble statues, that's for sure. Whereas in these other spaces, we're not expecting to find whole statues either because they were already excavated. You can see the whole map is colored in. It was all excavated. But it does help us, again, as I say, to recognize the boundaries, the limits of how much disturbance we can expect to encounter. So, here's our director again. Thank goodness our director has us all research these things and even gets together. This is a plan of some magnetometry readings he had taken with his geophysics team, in which you can find out what's under the ground without having to dig. It's a whole process itself that we don't have time to talk about right now, but so this is a subterranean reading that he's got. So he's pointing this out to us, telling us where we're going to penetrate the ground now, having looked already, gotten a little bit of an inkling of what lies under the ground already. Then you map out where the trench is going to go exactly, these holes in the ground, where exactly will you put them. So this is our space outside the city wall, outside Herculaneum Gate. Here's the villa of mosaic columns. This is where we put one trench 1 year. Here's our inside the city walls insula. We put trenches over here, and then we did small trenches, are really, they're called cleaning areas because we don't go very deep, over here and over here. So those are the precise areas. All right, that's the preparation. Let's put a hole in the ground. First, we propitiate the gods. We're lucky enough to dig in an area which has a lorarium, which is a shrine to the pagan gods in the Roman world. So we want to propitiate the gods before we touch trowel to earth. So here we are, our director's offering them a little glug of wine, which is the traditional Roman offering. Everybody's standing around observing the holy silence. Then we start measuring out the plot. What we're doing here is stretching out the measuring tapes to both sides to form a nice straight set of walls against which we can make measurements later on. You'll see how absolutely crucial these precise measurements are for the drawings we do, for the gaining of information. So getting these first two lines of these first two measurement lines are the most, is the most important of all the measurements that go on in archaeology, which is saying something because there are a lot of measurements that go on. But these are the important ones because these are the ones that you take all future measurements from. So as you imagine, these are, they're called the baselines because they really are the base from which all these other things are drawn. Very important to get these precise. Then finally, you can actually start digging. The first step in Pompeii today is simply to remove the upper layer of modern gravel that's been laid down because the whole site is so dusty, if it doesn't have gravel on top, that any breath of wind will blow this absolutely bone-dry dust, bone-dry for many months of the year, especially during the hot summers, blow it across the site, make everything just really miserable, especially the tourists. So there's gravel put down over most of the dirt around the site. Take back the gravel. Then you can see in this picture here, we're taking back actual dirt. So now we've gone down just a few inches, or centimeters, I should say. It's all metric here. So we've gone down, 6 to 8 centimeters. And that's it. We're pulling back layer by layer because we want to preserve intact any information we come across. We're not just trying to dig down until we find something and then yank it out of the ground. We're trying to use the dirt, too, to give us information. So what we found is, okay, we know what information the gravel is. That's 2011 vintage gravel that's been laid down. So we pull that off the top. Then we come down these 6 inches. We determined these are all circa 1999 era bottle caps that are coming up, plastic straws. So we'll take all that out. You can see here we've gone down really a lot. So we go down layer by layer by layer, sometimes in very cramped quarters. You can also see our very specialized equipment involves dustpans. I was surprised when I first saw these many years ago by now when I had my first season at Pompeii. Here's your trowel, Stephanie, and here's your Walgreens dustpan. Yes, these are what we use. So put the dirt in there, put the dirt in the bucket, and then the bucket brings it to the dump pile. You can see we're in close quarters here, so shoulder to shoulder, and sometimes the quarters are no more comfortable. Here we're not shoulder to shoulder, but we get into some pretty tight spaces, so it's not all fun and games. This is in fact our director who really took the blow here and went upside down in the hole to get every last scoop of gravel out of there. Moving on to the next. Here you can see the berm of dirt that we're removing. So here Chris is standing here, scooping into his dustpan. Here's what we've already scooped up, already cleaned. And he's pulling back layer by layer, pulling the layer back up this direction. And here's our director and our supervisor discussing what's going on. So throughout this whole process, again, think of that cyclical, that cycle, that recursive cycle. We're pulling back dirt. We're finding out information about the dirt as we pull it back, something we'll talk about in a second. How do you get information out of dirt? And that information is then informing the practice that moves us ahead in pulling out the dirt. How quickly do you pull out the dirt? Well, if you're still finding a bunch of plastic straws in it, then you can pull it out pretty quickly. Get out we call it the bulldozer trowel. It's the really heavy duty one. You can pull it out pretty quickly because you know that you're still in modern deposit. Whereas if you're past all the plastic straws, you might well be into Roman soil. So you want to be really careful to get all the information out of that you don't care to get out of the 1970s plastic straw soil. So here we're going quickly because we're still finding plastic straws. And in fact, we're finding, you can probably see, concrete frames. Concrete. It's not Roman concrete, unfortunately. We did all that research you saw in the library. We petitioned the superintendency to make sure that we could dig here. They didn't think anybody had dug there before. Well, at least now there's record that this place has been dug twice. We dug it second. It was dug already in the mid-20th century by Mayuri, an excavator who's famous for not recording many of the things that he dug. So here he apparently dug this spot, found several Samnite period graves. Remember, the Samnites were the predecessors to the Romans in this town. So he found several Samnite period graves, outlined them in concrete. He poured concrete around them, excavated the skeletons and the burial goods, probably, if they had them. We don't know. Put the concrete around them, and then invited people to come see them. How do we know he invited people to come see them? Because what we're excavating down to here is an extremely hard-packed surface. It's so hard that when we first got down to it, we thought, it's a concrete floor. Ooh, Roman concrete floor. Not at all. It was circa 1950, very hard-packed dirt floor from all the tourists coming to look at these Samnite period graves. So this is the cautionary tale. This, again, cyclical, right? We thought we did our research. In practice, we find out it's different, so now we have to modify our practice. Okay, so we're pulling dirt out of the ground. What do we do with the dirt? First, we sieve it. Here are the big sifters. We even have larger sifters than this, but these are the biggest hand sifters we have to sort out the dirt. You can see the dirt pile accumulating here from things that are not dirt. Things that are not dirt can include things that look like dirt but are not dirt, including this lump here you can see. It's a piece of stucco. Stucco is the same as plaster. Some people have more finely grained, so to speak, definitions of stucco versus plaster. But in any case, it's a stucco or plaster-like element. It's Roman. You can see this was plastered over reeds. They had a reed kind of wall that was made out of both cement, reed, and wooden framing. So you can see that this is a piece of plaster that was once pressed against reeds. So that's pretty neat. It tells us something about the construction of Roman buildings that had been in this area. They collapsed or were destroyed, so they're not standing. But this is useful for us because it tells us a little bit about what sorts of buildings were standing here. So this is the sort of thing we save. So the whole time, pulling out dirt, sieving it, inspecting it, modifying, standing around the trench, asking ourselves, what's going on here? This is a real live action shot of everybody standing around the trench. You can see we're all thinking, what is going on here? What is this trench trying to tell us? Sometimes the question mark is a big one. Let's move ahead. Okay, recording. Because, of course, Mayuri threw us for a loop by digging and not recording, so we try to record meticulously. Here's one of our trenches. This is the one in the suburban area outside the city walls in the Villa of Mosaic columns. These are not the mosaic columns, just other columns in the house. You can see the digging's going on over here, layer by layer. The dumping is going onto this dirt pile and sieving too. Here's our supervisor recording at the same time. So this is to emphasize that it is simultaneous. There's no point in which we are just digging and not recording. Recording happens at every step of the way, every scoop of the way. What's one method of recording? One is to take photographs that use these scale bars and the chalkboard to tell us precisely what are we looking at. And unfortunately, I don't have time to go into these interesting markings, the shorthand for what we are looking at. We're looking at a piece of the trench. Let's leave it at that for now. For publication, we'd probably crop out the top third of that image, but the bottom two-thirds gives you a good idea of this nicely cleaned area. You can see there's some scoop marks across that shows you that we've smoothed it to try to make the features appear that we want to appear and not the features that we think are just dirt or things that will mislead the viewer. So we're trying to give us a clean picture. Photography can also lead to very cool technology can lead our photography to very cool results. These are images compiled from many, many, many photographs of our trench. You can see there's some depth to these. These are two photos of the same trench. This circle here is a nice image of our cistern that was about yay big around. This is fairly new to our project that we're able to compile all of our images into 3D images like this, which is very useful for being able to revisit what we were doing at what time, revisit how the faces interact with each other, intersect each other. You can see it gets quite complicated with the cistern that was built over the this that was built next to the this. So it's nice to be able to revisit it after you're offsite, you're no longer in Pompeii, you're back in San Francisco trying to figure things out. We also take precise measurements using this machine that's called the Total Station. It's so-called total because it both takes measurements and has a computer inside that can process the measurements and connect them to a GPS coordinate system. So here we are taking very precise measurements. The great thing about this machine is it knows exactly where it is on the face of the Earth, so we can take very precise measurements of our trench here and geolocate it on the surface of the globe. That's useful for being able to relate our site to, especially to other sites dug by other people, which again we'll get to in a little more depth in just a moment. More recording. Drawing. Remember I told you the drawings that take place off those baselines, those first two measurement lines that we place for the trench. Here Megan's drawing a section, which means she's drawing the face of this wall here. We've taken away some dirt from the front of this wall that was abutting this wall at one time. Now the dirt's gone from it, so she's now mapping out what does that wall have to tell us. She's drawing it by stretching a measuring tape across it and taking measurements from that measuring tape down so that she can produce on this Mylar sheet a very accurate as possible drawing of what she's looking at. This is better than photography because, as you probably know, in many photographs, you can't make out from a photograph quite what your eye can see in real life. So in this way, she can highlight what she's seeing in real life. That is, that there's, for instance, a face between this kind of stone and a kind of stone below it. There's an interface between them that she can see with her naked eye that maybe a camera wouldn't be able to see. Oftentimes this is a two-person job with one person taking the measurements off the line who has to say, okay, at 60 centimeters across, there's a point 50 centimeters down, and the second person makes that mark on the Mylar tape. So it can be an arduous process, but very necessary. The other kind of drawing is to do so with a grid. This grid is simply a wooden frame with strings across it. You can see Megan leaning over the grid to try to get a top-down view of what's going on below and draw through the grid, just like an artist's grid with any other kind of drawing class that you might be familiar with, using the grid to translate what you see through the grid onto a piece of gridded paper. Sometimes, again, this is a two-person job and not necessarily comfortable because the idea is you want to be exactly over the archaeology but not stepping on it. So here Claire is very precariously balanced, trying to look straight down through the grid to make this accurate drawing. Now, this is maybe a moment to emphasize again our theme of the recursiveness of having to interpret and go through these procedures in a conscientious way. So the drawing is subjective to a certain degree because if you move your head even a little bit to the side, then all of a sudden the grid shifts, right? But we just do the best we can so far. There are a lot of digital processes that we also use that we're hoping correct for some of these subjectivities, and more those are becoming the way forward, of course. So we just have to say we do the best we can with, one, the resources we have, which are few in terms of finances, and two, with the time we have, because we can't be there for the whole year. Okay, I show you this picture again of pondering the trench because I want to draw your attention to this patch that may, to the untrained eye, look like a bunch of rocks lying on the ground. Well, they are a bunch of rocks lying on the ground, but that doesn't mean we don't want a very precise drawing of them. So there are those rocks all plotted on this drawing with, you see, these tick marks all represent measurements. They're all representing elevation because we want to know when we look at this drawing later, is this lower than this? Is this lower than this? I think this was a wall, but if it's higher than the things around it, that is a wall. If it's lower than the things around it, it's a trench, right? Because we don't have shading, we don't have anything. Fortunately, we take pictures too, so you would be able to hold a photograph next to it, but it's nice to be able to have the elevations to know exactly how much higher was it, because even a photograph wouldn't tell you that. So we take elevations across it. This patch of rubble lying on the dirt, we just didn't know. Maybe it's a wall that fell down, or maybe it's just a bunch of rocks that, again, our previous excavator, Maiori, threw over there because he didn't want those rocks in his trench. But we have to draw them because we don't know yet. A third kind of drawing that we do, not section drawing, not grid drawing, is drawing of the wall paintings. Now, we work in areas in which the wall paintings are not especially well preserved, so this wall was really the one that was worth drawing, the only one, sad but true. You can see from the picture, it looks pretty gray. It's very hard. This is another case in which the photograph won't turn up what your naked eye can see on site. So we draw it. Here's the drawing that I produced after a couple days of measuring the wall, looking very closely, trying to determine is that dirt or is that painting on the wall. And I brought in an example, not of the wall I was drawing, but a slightly better preserved one from elsewhere in Pompeii, just to show you what it might have looked like. It's a similar scheme. You can see the borders around these motifs in the center. So we're really grateful to have at least enough preserved now that we could produce this drawing, because every year the paintings fade more and more. So if we were to go back even next year or the year after, we might not be able to see even enough to make such a drawing. So it was worth doing that year. Similar, this is a detail from that same wall. And again, I brought in an example that looks somewhat similar. It is in bad shape, but it's much better preserved than the one that I was drawing that year. You can see it has that central frame with these curly Q, almost vegetal ornaments coming out the corners, and an ornament coming out the bottom, in this case coming out the top, and these decorative so-called tapestry borders. They look like nice embroidery borders coming out the sides. Processing. So we're digging, we're recording in these various ways. Now, what are we doing with the things that come out of the ground when we're digging? First, prosaic as it is, brush them off and try to figure out what they are. So we dig up a bunch of things like that piece of stucco I showed you that look like lumps. So the first step is to take your brush, take a bucket of things that look like lumps, and try to differentiate the lumps. Some of them are mortar with that, or plaster or stucco with the reeds impressed. Some are mortar, which is a more concrete-like substance than that nice white plaster. Some are pieces of painting that even have paint on one side. We didn't find very many of those, or none much bigger than your thumbnail, but some, and they're worth differentiating from the other things. Some are pieces of ancient brick. Some are pieces of terracotta pots. So these all can look very, very similar after being a long time in the ground. The edges are rubbed off, just like sea glass, and they're all about the same color because they're all covered with dirt. So we spend a long time brushing dirt off things. The pottery then gets washed. Here Aaron is using a standard, again, Walgreens brand toothbrush to scrub the pottery sherds. They're called sherds, not shards, when it's in archaeology for some reason. So here are all the sherds lying out to dry. So now you can at least differentiate some of the color. Then, if you're as lucky as we are, you have a fantastic pottery specialist. Here Victoria is teaching us. What kind of pottery is what? How can you identify the pottery just by looking at it? Now, she's much better than we all are at this, but at least she taught us enough that we could sort them out on the table. You can see we've masking taped the table here and marked each quadrant with an acronym that stands for a kind of pottery. So here we have BU for Bucoro, that's a kind of black pottery. We have RS for red slip, that's a beautiful kind of pottery that has a red glaze over it, it's a slip really, it's not got any glass in it, but it's got that glazed looking exterior, and BG for black gloss, that has that nice black glossy exterior. So we sort it out, then we draw it. If the fragment's big enough to draw, we use these radius charts to try to determine how big was the vessel that it came from, which tells us, was it a little cup or was it a big serving dish? That can tell us about what sort of activity was going on in this area, because if it was a big serving dish, it's a place where a lot of people came to eat. If it's a little cup, it might have been just one person eating. That can tell us a lot, whether it was a bar that served a bunch of people individually or was it somebody's dining room where there were more communal meals. So this then informs the way we go back to our hole in the ground to try to determine what sort of space it was. What was it used for? Here we are drawing the fragments, so we not only get the radius, but draw it as accurately as we can. Here's the radius chart being used. You can see some of the drawings being produced with the calipers at top to get those precise measurements when we can. Here is a particularly decorative piece of pottery that we found that was molded, so it's got texture to it, and that texture has to be recorded, again, as accurately as possible. This is something that a laser scanner could do. You put it in, close the door, you get a laser scan of it. It's great. But we can't afford a laser scanner. We can afford, however, 10 hours of work, which is how long it took to draw all these different sherds of pots. Not just this one, but everything on this paper took about 10 hours to draw. So when grad student labor is cheaper than laser scanning, that's the way it's going to happen for now. And our wonderful pottery expert did an absolute ton of drawing for us, so she's the one to do the most accurate and fast drawings of the sherds we find. Finally, we photograph the artifact. So here you can see the black velvet backdrop, the color and scale bars next to a neat lamp that we found, in fact, with some charcoal and some burned remains inside it, which is why it still looks dirty, because we didn't want to wash that stuff out. It can give us information about what's in there. So some kind of charcoal, definitely, when we'll get a specialist in to tell us what other sorts of residues might be in there, and a bronze nail. We found a lot of construction material in our area, so we know that it was under construction when the volcano erupted. It's a very cool site. The dirt itself, I told you the dirt itself can tell us things. What can it tell us? Well, you have to find out by washing the dirt. So first we pour a bunch of water into a bucket of dirt, and then you swirl it around and pour off some of the water into one of these new buckets to get out some of the gravel separated from the dirt. All the silty and sandy stuff gets sloughed off with the water, and all the stuff that isn't silt and sand, like gravel but other more interesting things as well, gets left behind. That stuff that gets left behind, we sieve through a series of sieves you can see here into different grades so that it's sorted from coarse to fine. Then you can dump it out onto a plate and see that it's all about the same coarseness, which was the purpose of sieving it. And you can see from the tweezers here where I'm going. What do you do with this? You bend over your plate of soup for as many hours a day as you can handle and use your little tweezers to move the gravel from one side of the plate to the other side of the plate, looking for things that are not rocks. Well, these are all things that are about, they're a millimeter across at some points, sometimes a little bit bigger. You can see here I'm picking up bits of shell or bone that are just yay big. Bits of bone that are that big oftentimes are not useful, but they can be, for instance, the end of the tibia of a mouse, which is telling us something, and those are about that big. Or they can be little bits of shell, which actually are more identifiable at that scale than most bone fragments are. And those shells can tell us things like, what were they eating, or were they not eating these things, but rather they were land snails, and maybe that indicates a garden that was here in Roman times. For those, and you can have a party doing this, for those, we package up all those tiny, tiny baggies of tiny, tiny fragments and put them in our very well-organized storeroom, as you can see. And then we get our specialist to come and whisk them away so we never have to look at them again. And the specialist can tell us quite what are these things. Here's our charcoal specialist. So we take out all the little bits of charcoal that we can find. She doesn't like ones that are so little they can't tell her anything. But she can determine things from very small pieces of charcoal. Things like what kind of wood it is. This is, in fact, her dissertation is about what kinds of wood are used across the peninsula. So you can find out really a lot. Moving ahead. Analysis of standing remains. Now, this is something that we're very happy to do. We're proud to have moved ahead in this particular area in a way that many other projects haven't. So what do? We look at the walls that are still standing remains, clear enough, and try to determine what sequence in which they were constructed, and what are they constructed of, and are these two walls that are across the insula from each other constructed out of the same mortar, which might indicate they were built at the same time? These are the questions we're asking so we can find out about the history of building on a larger scale. Here I'm standing in a room that shows really a lot of building phases. We have something in brick, we have something in black lava stones here, something in yellow stones here. We have a barrel vault up here that uses very white mortar as opposed to the mortars that are down here that are rather grayer in color, just to give you an idea of some of the things we look for. Also, we form the firing squad of cameras and take pictures of the walls with measuring bars so that, again, we can use that three-dimensional imaging technology that we use for the trench to make images of the walls. That can really help us, along with looking and the drawing of the walls, which we draw also, to highlight in the three-dimensional images, well, we see that this is one building phase. You see all those yellow rocks there are part of one big patch, and those are different from the other building phases. Survey. This is, again, a measuring tool that you've seen before. We used it in the trench. This is our geolocating tool. Well, we use it also to take very precise measurements of the standing remains as well. So here, the machine is taking the measurement off of this rod, which has a reflector that tells it where it's taking its measurement, and we do that all over the monuments that we can so that we can put those into our wonderful map. So this is all created by those little points that we took with that magical machine on a tripod. It's absolutely spectacular, the things that we can get, how precise the measurements are. They're within about a half centimeter. And now we know precisely where on the globe all this stuff is, how it exists today, because when it crumbles, unfortunately, as it's doing these days, we'll at least have a record of what was standing. And we'll be able to put it against our records of the construction phases so that we can say something about, well, was this part of the insula all built in a go so that we think the homeowner here also built those shops? Or did the shops already exist and then the homeowner butted in and said, I'm taking this all over for my nice big garden space, which we think might have happened in some of these cases. Packing up. Now you've got a bunch of dirt out of the ground. And the superintendency wants you to put it all back in the ground. So here we are, putting all the dirt back into the trench. This was one of the years in which we wanted to come back to this trench. We hadn't gotten to the bottom. That's to say, we want to get down to soil that the Romans didn't touch. It's called the natural soil that's never been touched by human hands. We want to get down there so we're sure there's no more information at the bottom that we can get out about the Roman period. So we hadn't quite gotten there, so we tarped it and then put the dirt over the tarp so that when we come back the next year, we can take all that dirt off the top of the tarp and know exactly that boundary that we got to the year before, because that's the tarp. Bucket Brigade does the work. You tamp it down as you go, and in the end, you want it to look just as if you'd never been there before. So we even put the gravel back on the top to make the superintendency happy. We pack up the storeroom, put the tarp over all the artifacts so they don't get too much dustier than they already are after we've gone all the trouble of toothbrushing every pot fragment. And we even pack up our tents. We stay in tents in this beautiful orchard next to the site, so you can see the outlines of our tents. Those don't erase quite as easily even as the trench. We submit a field report before we absolutely leave the site. So here's our field report we submit to the superintendency. They want it before we take off in the plane because they want to be able to tell us, no, you submit that. We want your information on file, because they have been learning the lessons of people like Maiori who haven't submitted the excavation reports. So they absolutely require this. We do that. We do lists of the artifacts we found, and these are lists of every individual feature that we dug. And a feature can be anything from a wall that came out in our excavation trench, or even a little pit that looks like it was a hole just this big that was excavated to throw in, I don't know, a couple coins somebody wanted to save for later, or a couple chicken bones from dinner, and then was padded back down. And once we find that as we're excavating down and down and down, that gets its own number, and it goes into the list. And this is only about half the list from one season, so there are really a lot of those. The rest of the year, we do things like publish. We want to publish our results so that people know what we're finding, because there are a lot of teams working in Pompeii, and we want this project, especially our project, takes pride in making our information public. I mean, as public as it can be. It's on the internet. Anybody can look at it. So we're hoping that the other teams will be able to look at our information, corroborate it with theirs, look at our georeferencing, see if anything matches with theirs. It's really important to be able to work with the other sites like this. We look in the library to try to figure out, what was that kind of pot we found? Or was that wall construction common in the first century BC, or was it totally unusual? In which case, that we'd do some more research about that. We digitize the pot drawings. So these are the drawings we did of those little pot sherds. Digitize them at home. We have some great people who have done all the tracing through using some nice software for that. And of course, we have the computers running constantly, turning those photographs into the three-dimensional images. It takes a lot of horsepower, so the computers are running on that for rather a while. And always a good back-of-the-napkin sketch over brunch with some of the other project members to think about what are we going to do next year. What did we find out? There's a long gestation period for what's coming, and there's also a lot of digestion period for what we just did. I'd like to end with some special thanks just for the project, the directors who are so wonderful, some friends who lent me some photographs for this, and of course the superintendency and minister for culture who let us excavate at this wonderful site. And thanks very much for your attention.
Thanks, Stephanie, for that great talk and a little insight into the daily life of an archaeologist that I'm sure is a little more dirt than we were thinking. So, who has the first question? Great.
How was your project funded?
That's a very good question. Funding's always a problem. Our director, bless his heart, is the one to seek out the funding for us. So he's got some funding through San Francisco State University, which provided us the money, for instance, to buy the total machine on a tripod, which has helped us in such immense ways. And those of us who participate on the project, so far it's been on a volunteer basis, so we simply apply for our own travel grants to get over there and money to live. Thank goodness we stay in tents because it's so cheap, so this helps us individually, but until we get nonprofit status so that we can apply for some other good grants or until we win a good NEH grant, something like that, it's cobbled together by all of us.
I have the next question. Really good job presenting what you did. It's a lot of information. I can't imagine how you pulled that all together so well like that. But my question is, was there anything in particularly outstanding that you found on that trip?
That's a great question. My answer, of course, is yes. And you might be surprised by what that thing was. Drains! We found 5 drains. It was very exciting. So when... We dig at this corner by the forum, as you saw, where a lot of tourists come by because the tourists come through the forum and then they actually stop right next to our trench because right there, you're on your way from the forum to the next point on the tour and you can look down our street to see the island of Capri. So the tour guides always stop their groups and say, look at the beautiful island of Capri and look past all the archaeologists that are working. So we're often asked, and the answer is never gold coins or nice statuary. We say, drains, and we found a cistern. But it was very exciting because these drains indicate there was something massive going on. It's not just somebody's storm gutter. It's this series of really 5 drains all leading from just north of where our trench ended to south of where our trench ended, which was to say into the street. So all the drains in ancient Rome went into the streets and they had a good drainage system so that the streets were running with water. They were cleanly flushed outside the city. So all this water that they were channeling was coming from somewhere that it had to be a manufacturing site. So we were really excited to find that because we were digging a house area and part of a house area that had been converted into a shop area and maybe a bar area. But we hadn't expected at all to find something that's industrial. So this was industrial production that involved a lot of water. It might have been dyeing, it might have been laundry, it might have even been metalworking that requires some water. We're not sure at this point, but when we kept finding drain after drain, we almost couldn't believe it. So that's the sort of thing we're finding. We found some coins, but they're all bronze, they're no gold. We're not finding any jewelry. We're not even finding painting fragments really bigger than your thumbnail. So nothing spectacular, nothing that you put on display in a museum, but we're certainly finding out a lot of information that I think it's going to change the way that we look at Pompeii and space in Pompeii. So exciting things nonetheless. Thanks.
It's interesting that the first part of the archaeology was done there in the 18th century. I mean, that's the rediscovery of it. Right now, of course, we're very used to plumbing, indoor plumbing. Yeah. But at the time that they were doing, there wasn't a lot of indoor plumbing in Europe.
Right.
Did they think, my goodness, we're 1,700 years later, and these guys were way ahead of us in drainage?
I think
that would be the reaction.
Right. I think you're right. I think it should have been. I don't know that it was because... there's some spots, like, if you've been to Rome, there's a place called the Crypta Balbi, which is an archaeological site right in the center of Rome. It's near the Lago Argentino, which is a nice sunken site that has 4 really well-preserved Roman Republican temples. So you can stand in the middle of, it's now the jewelry shopping district, so you can stand there and look down on the temples. This archaeological museum shows that this site progressed over time. It shows how the site progressed over time from Roman Republican period into the Middle Ages. And it shows that people... after the Roman Empire fell, and there's controversy about that, but that the people didn't show at least not reverence for the site. So they were building lean-tos against the temple columns and turning porticos from the big basilicas or the theaters there into pigsties and this sort of thing that makes us as the Romanists say, oh, how terrible. But they were living, they were making use of what they had. So on the one hand, I think it seems to me that they must have seen these great things and thought, wow, what an amazing older civilization this was. It must be hallowed in their minds. But from the way they treated it, I'm not sure how they viewed it. I think, and that would go for the technology too, the aqueducts that stopped running in the 5th century. The aqueducts ran for 300 years after the Romans were really at their peak, and nobody took care of them, so then they stopped running. And why didn't they just keep them going? Didn't they have some respect for the technology or some need for it? So I think I'm as bamboozled by it, or confused by it as it seems. Yeah.
As you go down the depths, I assume the deeper you go, the older it is. But
yeah.
But with the fact that people were digging and moving things around and potentially corrupting that,
right?
Did you need to use any technology dating things, carbon, radioactive, or whatnot?
Yeah, great question. We didn't use any carbon dating for this. In part because the areas that we dug, we didn't find very much disturbance from the earlier centuries, from the earlier excavations. Most of the earlier excavations, like the ones in the 18th century that were looking for the looted goods, they kept the digging for themselves easy, which means that most of the time they simply cleared out the area of all the pumice stone that fell from the volcano that covered the city. But they didn't go lower, because the pumice stone, if you hold it in your hand, it's like holding a styrofoam peanut. So they would come in, their troop of, you can imagine these men in their 18th century garb, they're coming through with some workmen, some local workmen, and they're really just shoveling. Today we use garbage bags to hold the pumice, but back then they use whatever they have. They use the shovels and rakes, and they can just sweep it. It's like sweeping styrofoam peanuts from this room that you want to get stuff out of into this room that's empty because you already got the stuff out of it. And they just take the things that are buried in the styrofoam peanuts. But they don't go down into the dirt. So that's the case for most of Pompeii, and that was definitely the case for us. So that pumice is no longer on the surface of the dirt where we were excavating. Therefore, we weren't clearing any of that in garbage bags or otherwise. So we were at the dirt level, which they hadn't disturbed at that point. In our insula, one of the interesting disturbances that we have had to deal with is bombing from World War II. Why Pompeii was bombed in World War II, nobody has come out with a clear answer, but it's either that it was a mistake because it was bombed by the Allies because the Allies were actually aiming for a center that was close to Pompeii but not Pompeii, or possibly that weapons were being stored at Pompeii because it was thought, as in Iraq not so very long ago, it was thought that this World Heritage Site or pre-World Heritage Site wouldn't be bombed, that the Allies would have some compunction against bombing the site, so they stored their things there, or that that's what was thought was happening. So in any case, Pompeii was actually quite severely bombed, and our insula, especially, that's why I showed you that very early picture of that nice grassy expanse. That's because a big bomb fell there. It's not because, I mean, those walls were standing. We have some great pictures of the walls that were standing even as late as the 1930s, some photographs of nicely preserved houses with paintings and really beautiful things that then all went up. So lucky for us in a way, because that means that nobody else, no other team today dug here because they all thought it was bombed to pieces. So our director at least had the insight to start thinking about it and realize that there was something under the ground to still explore.
What kind of credentials do you think teams need to get permission to dig? And did the superintendent come out every once in a while and check to make sure everything
Yes.
is professionally done?
Yes, very good question. So maybe I should have included a picture of our superintendent envoy, because we did. We had two. So let's see. I'm sorry. Remind me of the first part of your question.
What kind of credentials?
The credentials, right.
You can't be the neighborhood archaeological
club. Right. That's an excellent question, and one that I'm afraid I just don't know the answer to. Apparently, you can be a professor at San Francisco State, and they will give you a place to dig. But it's not just that. Our field director, Michael, has a very long pedigree of having dug there. It's not a nepotistic system, but it is somewhat inherited, because you have to, as you're obviously guessing, you have to have proven yourself in some way. So the way Michael did that was he spent, I think it was 15 years, digging with another project on the site that had been started by, again, somebody who had been digging long enough to get his own project. So Michael had grown up in the tutelage of this gentleman and then branched off to start his own dig. So by then he already had a long record and has gone really to great lengths to ingratiate himself with the superintendency to make sure he does everything on time, by the book, make sure he asks for everything. So that actually, that goes a really long way as well. Credentials are almost beside the point for that part. Let's see. And I started answering your second question first, but then... I see, right. That's right. We have two envoys. So one of them is assigned for us for safety, to make sure that what we're doing is safe. The other one is to, I assume he makes sure things are safe as well, but he's a little bit higher in the chain. He's right under the superintendent and makes sure that we're doing proper procedure and so forth. So they're both archaeologists as well, in order that they be able to tell what we're doing is correct or not correct. Yeah.
Thank you. That was just a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
My question is, my understanding is that the entire archaeological site of Pompeii is about 117 acres, mm-hmm. and that out of that, 35 have been excavated, more or less. Mm-hmm. What do you know about, are there plans to continue the excavation, and what time frame?
That's great. Okay. Now, I can't convert from hectares to acres. I know it's 66 hectares. and the number I have in my mind is that two-thirds have been excavated, which is a little bit different from what you said. But in any case, you're right. It's a fraction. A fraction has been. Some of it, let's see, can I go back quickly to my map? So be it a third or however much is unexcavated, is left unexcavated because the superintendency, well, for one thing, they're absolutely overwhelmed with how much they already have to preserve. As you read in the papers about the collapses that are happening all too often, they know that the more that's excavated, the more they have to try to conserve. So, this does. So on this map, the dotted lines indicate streets that we know go through but are lying under current overburden, aka dirt that's piled up. So this whole area here that's between here and the city wall, and then this large swath here. And a little bit down here. So this unexcavated part is being kept unexcavated for that reason, but also because we know that archaeological technology is developing, as I already made allusions to with this digital technology we're going forward with. But it's not just the digital. It's also knowing that my director's example is archaeologists will come back to the place we dug and we thought we were so conscientious about, and they'll look at our records and say, they didn't take the temperature of the soil as they were digging? Did they not know anything? Now we can take the temperature to find out X, Y, or Z. So this is something we joke about, but we joke about with a purpose, to remind ourselves that there's a reason that we don't want to excavate up there. It's because we know we can't do it as well as people in the future will do.
Earlier in your presentation, you talked about the difference in social life inside and outside the city walls, and with the map up, maybe could you go back to that and give a couple of examples?
Yeah. Sorry, this map or a different map you had in mind? To talk a little bit about the difference inside and outside. This is fascinating. So I'll try to make this short and sweet because it's really a topic that people need to write books about. And I think our project is the first step on the way to writing more books about this. You know where our insula is. Our second insula is down here. It's always been thought that Pompeii grew from a small kernel that's called the Altstadt, because the German archaeologists are the ones because Germans made the discipline of archaeology as we know it today, so we use German terms for a lot of this stuff, but also because the Germans worked on Pompeii, the earliest of many people. So the Altstadt, so-called, just means the old city. So this old city was thought to have encompassed the Forum, what's the Forum today still, and somewhere around the Forum like this, just a little, I mean, it's a fraction the size, maybe a sixth or even an eighth the size of the modern city. So it's still thought that this Altstadt, this old city, was the kernel from which the rest of the city then expanded. It ballooned out almost like a piece of popcorn coming out from this kernel. And therefore, that what lies inside this old kernel should be qualitatively different from what lies outside, and should definitely be different from what lies outside the city walls. Because aren't city walls supposed to protect something? Where do you draw the line? The Romans are doing us a favor, it should seem, and actually pre-Roman, because the Samnites started their own wall, doing us a favor by telling us, we believe that this is a line demarcating something qualitatively different in here and out here. In here, it's stuff we want to protect. Out here, it's stuff we don't care about protecting. So we as archaeologists look at this and think, okay, that makes sense. So it is different. But although that may have been the case for the Samnites, it may have been the case in the 4th century BC, 3rd century BC, maybe even 2nd century BC. By the 1st century BC, when the Romans are really moving in, it's not the case anymore. So what our project is trying to do is to bring the evidence forward that shows us that it's not so very different outside the walls as inside the walls, and not so very different in the so-called Altstadt area, which you can see is higgledy-piggledy with the way the streets go, as opposed to the nice gridded streets over here, just like a lot of modern cities today. The old medieval city is the part with the squiggly streets, and the modern city has those nice gridded streets, or less nice gridded streets, depending on your preference. So Altstadt versus rest of the inside of the city walls versus outside city walls. These are three terms that we're just trying to, we're trying to make them more confusing. We're trying to make people question these divisions. What we're finding, I'll just give you an example and then I'll have to stop probably, is that outside the city walls, the Romans buried their dead, certainly. They had a taboo against burying dead inside the city walls. So all this area is, this street, in fact, is called the Street of the Tombs, the Street of the Sepulchres. And down here is another Street of the Tombs, Street of the Sepulchres, with lots of tombs lining both sides. The tombs are what people see today. So you walk down the Street of the Tombs and you see tombs, back to back, or all shoulder to shoulder, what have you. But as you already know, there's a villa up here too. Well, you build the villas outside the city walls because that's where the space is. You build the tombs out there because they're taboo, but you also build the really nice luxury palace-style houses out there because that's where there's space. In here, you couldn't build your nice big garden area and so forth. So that already complexifies what we thought we know about what's outside, is that we're saying, well, there's this luxury space out here alongside all these no-touch-em spaces. And what I also mentioned just briefly, next to the Villa of Mosaic Columns, there's this whole row of shops. Look at all those shops. So we're also saying, hey, there's a bunch of commercial space out here. And it only makes sense because people coming into the city, they're coming on cart, they're hot, they're tired. The next city, you know, it's not that far away, but it's still a good cart ride away, and it's on hard streets. So, of course, people are going to want to get off and get a drink. There's a fountain right here. They want to fill up on some water. They want to buy a souvenir before they go home, whatever it is. We also know prostitutes hung around outside city gates precisely because that's where people are coming in and out. There's a lot of traffic. So we're just trying to show with this inside versus outside, there's commercial space, there's residential space, there's municipal space, there's with the aqueducts that are coming into the city. And finally, there's this tomb space. And the tomb space is really different from what's inside. There aren't tombs inside the city. So that we can really make a firm thumbprint on that. That is different. But this other stuff we're trying to say, you know, look at the outside space. By this period, at least, you know, as I said, regardless of 4th, 5th century, 3rd century BC, by this period, we can't draw that line as easily.
All right. We have time for one more question, and I would like to let everyone know who has an interest in even more about Pompeii that these pamphlets are out in front. There's a program this weekend that Humanities West is putting on at the Herbst Theater, a two-day program, Friday night and Saturday. That's tomorrow and the next day. Stephanie will be speaking, so will Michael Anderson, who ran your program. He'll be speaking as well, and several other professors. So who has the last question?
I wonder, in many of these sites, there's always a question of stabilization or reconstruction. And I'm wondering whether there's any attempt as part of your project that they wanted you to do either stabilization of stuff that you're excavating or reconstruction, which they see as important for tourism, which obviously the site is very important for.
Yes, astute point. One of the last meetings our director had with the new director, superintendent of the site, who actually has since been replaced, I think, two, if not three times, because there's so much turnover right now with the bureaucracy or the administration of the site. One of the last meetings our director had, he was told, Michele, restauro, which means, of course, restoration, said three times for emphasis. So this was said to our group, not because they had been seeing a lack of restoration, because let's be honest, we haven't found anything that needs restoration. We found some walls, but we buried those back with the dirt that we had excavated. So those are preserved again because they're buttressed now by all this dirt we refilled our hole with. And we didn't leave anything standing from our excavation. We do have the standing remains still in the insula, which we'd like to conserve, but again, the question is money. So the idea for our project moving forward is to team up with the folks who run the project right down the street, or not even down the street, right next door to us. We're digging here, they're digging here, right against the city wall. They're in these beautiful houses that use the city wall to get up higher so that they can get the better sea view out to the Bay of Naples. So these are the most luxurious houses there are in Pompeii. So they're conserving, since these houses are so nice and they're well preserved, the teams that work here are conserving just as much as they're digging, at least, if not more, because they have beautiful paintings to conserve. So our idea is we want to get to know those folks more so they can try to give us an inroad, teach us even the first bit about conserving so that then we can go on to, I hope, even get a specialist in conservation to help at least buttress some of those standing walls that are starting to lean a little bit too much.
Great. I want to thank you again, Stephanie, for a wonderful talk. Very informative, and I want to thank the audience here at the Commonwealth Club and our radio and online audiences. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 109th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.